coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
A very festive Borag Thung from the 2000 AD Thrillcast Earthlit. I'm your host, Molchar, and what a year it's been. Thank you to every single one of you for supporting the Galaxy's Greatest Podcast as we've brought you information from behind the scenes at 2000 AD. We've given you interviews, we've given you chats with editorial, we brought you panels from our 40th anniversary convention, and what a year it's been, 40 years of 2000 AD, and absolutely clear as day that another four decades is a shoo-in for Britain's best comic. Again, I want to say thank you to every single listener who has tuned in every fortnight, who's spread the word, who's left us a review, who's given us some feedback about things they'd like to see. Thank you to every single one of us. We couldn't do this without you. We hope you've enjoyed the last 12 months of the podcast. And, well, you know, we're coming up to our third birthday on the 20th of January. So, yeah, we'll be putting together a nice episode for that. In the spirit of all good Christmas specials, we decided to look back over the last year and bring you some of our highlights from 37 individual episodes of the Galaxy's Greatest Podcast. So make sure you sit back, relax, put your feet up, continue digesting whatever food you've stuffed into your gob over the last few days, and take a trip down memory lane with the 2008 Thrillcast. So let's kick off with Ulysses Farinas and Eric Freitas, who talked a little bit about their IDW Judge Dredd series, Mega City Zero. As somebody who didn't necessarily know the strip all that well, what was your experience of that first movie back in, what was it, 95?
Oh, I have to be honest. I thought it was, I don't remember if it was the sequel or the first movie of a trilogy that I made up in my head with Demolition Man, Judge Dredd, and Super Mario Brothers. Those three movies were somehow all together for me, and I just didn't tell anyone because I honestly thought that just made perfect sense. And why do I need to bring it up?
It does make perfect sense.
I would like to see somebody do some kind of bridging comics to explain how you jump from one to the other.
Yeah, exactly. With Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
Throughout the whole thing.
Well, that brings me on to something I wanted to talk about was that you do see some criticism from fans saying this is too different. This is not the Dredd that we're used to. This isn't Dredd. But I guess the point that you know, you're making, and I've seen you make in interviews before, is that this isn't meant to be the same Dredd. This is, you know, a very different take on the same source material.
It isn't. It's as different a take on the source material as the Carl Urban Dredd movie is, which is significantly different from the comics, but still, you can still, it still resonates. It still reads as a great version of Dredd. But I wouldn't, you know, I would never, if someone said that the only type of Dredd I can get was Carl Urban Dredd, I would feel it was a bit limited, you know? So I think anytime you write a character, anytime new writers come to a character, even then the character is not the same, you know? Steve Ditko's Spider-Man is completely different than Dan Slott's Spider-Man. They're really not the same character anymore. So I just think, when you look at like the Dredd that we're doing, it's not the same Dredd. It's not supposed to be.
Yeah, and another thing to touch on that, to me, yes, it's not the same Dredd, but I mean, a lot of it is. It's still his same reactions to things, you know? Like, we were very careful to make sure this is to put Dredd in situations, made him feel uncomfortable. And that was really the only difference. And then he would always react like Dredd. So when like people kind of say that, I'm like, what you really mean is you kind of just want like another procedural cop story where Dredd figures it out at the end, which I understand. I mean, you know, that's what they want. And, you know, that's just not, we felt like we didn't want to get lost in a shuffle. If anything else, we wanted to stand out with our Dredd, you know, and at least be remembered for something. And we figured getting rid of Mega City 1 and putting in something completely different would be fun.
Yeah. I think the core of Judge Dredd is these bizarre science fiction stories and seeing these just unexpected takes. Where, you know, like I said, when I first read America, that satirical take on democracy, that approach of what is this dark twist we can put on it? That is, I think, what Dredd is about. And that's the core right there.
It was a privilege to talk to former Vertigo editor-in-chief Karen Berger about the beginnings, the practicalities, and the ongoing legacy of the British invasion.
When you were editing these titles, you had people like Dick Giordano, Joe Orlando, Paul Levitz, who seemed to be keeping an eye on the on the British industry, the titles like 2000 AD and Warrior that were coming up. Was this something that struck you at the time, or was it just kind of background that this is where they drew ideas and influences from?
No, I mean, I still remember, I was still editorial coordinator, so it was right before I became a full-time editor, and Dick and Joe had just come back from London, you know, and it's talked about in the Future Shock documentary, where Dick and Joe came to England to look for, you know, to look for great comics, the great comics talent that was working at 2000 AD. And Warrior, I believe at that time Warrior had already gone under, I'm pretty sure, I forget what year this was. So they already had on their radar, you know, the British writers and artists. And Paul was also very, you know, connected to Nick Landau and Richard Britton, who were, you know, big comics fans turned comic professionals, obviously.
Yeah.
So Nick with Forbidden Planet and Titan Books, as we all know, and Richard was an editor for many years. So he was sort of, you know, fandom. They all came out of fandom, which I was never a part of, but that was, I think, a very big connective force in those days of comics. So it was sort of a kind of, you know, our relations in England kind of thing, you know. that was sort of the way it seemed. And so it was, so that's kind of how I remember first even hearing about 2000 AD. And this was probably, and it was soon after, so this was early 80s, 2000 AD launched in 77. I just remember looking at the stuff, and they were brought back, and I'd seen some 2000 AD stuff before, but I never really kind of got into it, and I never really devoted much time to reading it. But when they came back and was showing me this art, I still remember them showing me Steve Dillon's, first time I'd seen Steve Dillon's work. And they were saying, hey, this guy's only 16. I'm like, oh man, this guy's, I can't believe it. So anyway, and then, you know, I started, you know, I got my hands on some Warriors and was reading the material there. I don't know how the hell I did it, because I don't even know how it was available in the States. Must have been through Len or Paul or somebody. I don't really remember. But yeah, that was sort of my first exposure to the British talent. It was in the early 80s.
Do you think it was 2000 AD's ability to integrate politics and action in a more subtle way that allowed that meant that when these writers and artists came in, they it seemed very fresh and unusual and hard and sharp?
You know, I think they were great storytellers at the end of the day. Yeah. You know, it's all those things. Yes, you know, it's great writers, great storytellers, really knowing how to craft a story and how to grab a reader. So yes, it's all those things. And I think it was, again, just a different kind of feel, a different flavor. There was, you know, got a sense that the British writers were drawing more of their work more from, you know, present day events, but also from history, from literature, from mythology. It just seemed like there was a wider spectrum of literary influences and world influences that they were bringing to their work, because they weren't sort of stuck into the superhero trappings of continuity. And because, again, all that stuff, which I hate, you know, was such a big part of American comics. And it still is. Again, not that you can't do really powerful work. And there has been a lot of powerful work done in superhero, not in the superhero genre. And, you know, I don't mean to knock it, but it needed a big change. American comics just needed a big change. And I think this, you know, it could have been a better time for this. From my perspective, because you know, I wasn't a superhero reader, and I don't think I would have stayed at DC if I didn't have this other cool stuff to edit. I mean, when I came in, I was lucky enough that DC still had books like, you know, House of Mystery, and they Amethyst was really like a fluke book that they decided that they were going to do at the time, and Legion of Superheroes was still its superhero book, but it's really more, you know, science fiction and relationship oriented title. So, you know, they were all sort of off the cuff. I didn't really have to worry about continuity, thankfully. I mean, I was sort of, I think I had an anxiety attack when I first got the Legion, because I was like, oh my God, I have to learn who all these characters are, their real names, their alien names, their English names. I was like, I sort of freaked out about that. But, and that was sort of my last real, my one and only kind of true superhero book, and even that was kind of off the spectrum. And Wonder Woman, to me, I never even saw as a superhero. She was just this, you know, this character who happened to have these abilities that were superhuman. But to me, it was not a, you know, her world and her abilities and her point of view came from, again, this whole mythological background infused with a modern perspective.
One thing that crops up during the course of the 80s is obviously reference to DC coming along and taking a talent over to the States, and particularly when I think Alan was working on Halo Jones at the same time he was working on Swamp Thing, and you know he starts to see the editorial starts to see conflicts happening there. Did you get any sort of sense from through the creators that the editorial at 2000 AD was annoyed or getting miffed that this process was going on?
Oh, I had a feeling that people hated me. I mean, over there, just as I probably would have hated myself too. So, if I was in that position, so, I mean, it's, you know, it's just kind of what happened. I mean, you know, you work it's not totally dissimilar to my later years working at Vertigo, where new people would come in and we'd give, you know, stars to Jeff Lemire and Scott Snyder, and they'd be quickly swooped up and given gobs of money by the superhero people at DC and, you know, and at Marvel. So it's not dissimilar in that way. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, kind of the way that it is. So, yeah.
To go alongside our 40th anniversary, we updated and republished Thrill Power Overload, the official history of 2000 AD. And we had David Bishop, former Tharg, and writer Carl Stock on to talk about going behind the scenes on the galaxy's greatest.
A lot of people remember things in different ways, and the further you get away from events, the truth, or capital T or small T, becomes sort of blurrier with memory. Because whenever I run into people at comics events, they'll busy tell me, "Oh, you wrote this scathing rejection of me," and I'm always sorry, because I had a slight tendency to go scathing when it came to rejections. Although most of the people who say that to me also are now perfectly successful creators, and they will put their hand up to, "Yeah, I wasn't ready. It's fine." It was just a bit harsh going at the time, but then that's kind of my editorial style, alas, as I can see from distance now. But there were times when I was writing the original articles and then doing the revised Thrill Power Overload, the book, and there was simply no way of knowing what the truth, capital T, small t, the reality of a situation was. And the best I could do was sort of present contrasting versions of what had happened and go for some sort of Rashomon effect where you just see what everybody's version of events were and you leave it to the reader to try and draw their own conclusions. So that's always the challenge. I mean, it always cracks me up. There's one particular creator who will perpetually bang on about the history of 2000 AD being subject to blatant revisionism, and then produces their own version of events, which some people might consider to be slightly revisionist, but without naming any names in particular. But anyway, the best you can do as a journalist, and my approach to the book, although, you know, I was a character in the book effectively, in events, in some of the events depicted, was to try and be as objective a journalist as a writer as I could, because, I mean, it's not easy. When you get to your own period in the comic, you are blinded by what happened at the time, but you have to be willing to try and, you know, allow other people to completely have their say and voice their opinion and then present that to the reader and let, you know, history make its judgment.
What did doing Thrill Power Overload do to your appreciation of the comic? Did it bring it to life? Did it help it? Did it encourage it? Or has it given you a darker perspective or anything like that?
Darker perspective. interesting question. I think it certainly gave me an appreciation for what previous editorial teams had gone through. It was the sort of the discovery, the number of bullets that it dodged over the years when it could easily have ceased to exist. And when you think about the dozens and dozens of writers and artists and colorers and colorists and letterers who have worked on the title, who've gone on and worked in other fields, both in comics but also film and TV and computer games, and it's when you step back and you sort of see the entirety of the journey that you appreciate just how big a presence 2000 AD has been in the creative industries, the impact it has had for people who has worked on it, the importance of it for a lot of people as a stepping stone to other areas. I think it gave me a much bigger appreciation of the importance of 2000 AD. It's sort of when it's the thing that Carl was talking about, the idea that when you read it week to week, you don't sort of appreciate the magnitude of the achievement or the hundreds and thousands of achievements that have emerged from it as a title, the things that it's managed to pull off on a limited budget, often, and with, you know, limited resources, and yet it's able to achieve some wondrous things. It certainly didn't darken my perspective of 2000 AD. I will admit that after I finished the book, I did flog my collect back copies of 2000 AD, but I suddenly discovered that the office I work in became a lot colder when I didn't have my walls insulated by all that Thrill Power.
One of the all-time classics from 2000 AD is, of course, Nikolai Dante, the Russian Rogue. And it was great to welcome Robbie Morrison and Simon Fraser, the creators of Dante, to do a little retrospective all these years after the series came to an end.
The amount of feedback I got from Dave Bishop was, I think you were supposed to hand in some artwork this week. And that was it.
That's a remarkable impression.
Yeah.
Actually, all you really get from Dave is a sister. That was it. That was how he started the phone call every time. And it's like, at that time, you just crumble. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, Dave. I'm sorry. I'm late. I'm sorry.
Well, Simon, the original pitch was Robbie's. How did you come to be working on Dante in the first place?
Well, we got on really well. I mean, we did Shimura together, and I think it went really well. I think we got a good rapport.
The truth is, I was actually quite reluctant to have Simon on it initially.
Here we go. Here it comes.
Because, it was John Thomason. I think John Thomason initially said, he was thinking of having Simon as the artist on it. And I was sort of grumbling about it because basically I was being the mercenary freelancer and thinking, no, wait a minute, Simon's drawn Shimura at the moment and he's doing a pretty good job over it. I'm quite happy to have him there. If I could get somebody else to draw this, then I've got potentially two ongoing series with artists. So I was quite happy there, but John was quite intent on having Simon on it, and then so was David. Actually, when as soon as David came on board, he wanted Simon on as well. I guess because it suited David from moving from the magazine on to 2000 AD that he would have been the pair of us who he trusted on it, and he knew we would do a good job. Hopefully,
in fairness, where could we have gone with Shimura? I mean, it was already the most depressing strip in the comic.
Dante has been and gone. The story is told. 14 years of comic books. Looking back on it now, what's the moment that sticks out for you? What is the moment where the good or bad really kind of shines out as, you know, a seminal moment or an important moment in the strip's life?
I think the end of Love and War, when is basically Dante standing on the beach, where everything he thought was going to be a certain way just fell apart because things are moving behind the scenes that he's not in charge of, and suddenly his whole life, well, what he thought was going to happen has been completely ripped away from him. And then you've got this horrible sequence, a horrible few years of his life. Great storytelling, but horrible few years for him. I think that was kind of the point where it kind of stepped up. It was no longer just like adventures and romps in the world of Nicolai Dante, starring Nicolai Dante. It was like, this is some horrible, horrible shit that's going to happen to this guy, and he's going to survive it, but only just. And that was what made it really fun. That's what made it really interesting for me. Just to looking back on it, I think that really stands up very well. That by the end of that first third year, I think we're at the third year at that point. But it really sort of changed markedly.
Of course, along with the 40th anniversary, the big news of this year was the announcement that Judge Dredd Megacity 1 will be coming to TV screens in the future. So we sat down with Jason Kingsley, co-owner of Rebellion, and producer Brian Jenkins to give fans a little indication of what they can expect. I'm going to ask the most pressing question first.
Okay, go for it then.
Oh, no. Right at the very beginning.
Yeah, you're going to throw
a bouncer at us,
aren't
you?
Start
at least wait till the end.
My way down. Carl Urban.
Yes, there's been a lot of interest in that question. I'm going to leave it to you.
Great thing about Carl is he's actually a big fan of the comic book, and he's a really nice guy, and I know him well enough to speak to him personally. We have had many conversations prior to this about all sorts of different things, and he's also a very busy full-time professional actor, so we are going to have some long and complicated conversations, I would imagine, and we'll see where we go. It's too early to tell yet, but if we can use him, then and he is available to us, then I think that would be absolutely brilliant.
Something I think is quite important is that a lot of people have wanted Dredd 2, and unfortunately, this isn't Dredd 2. Mm. And for us, the benefits of this is that we'll be able to give, you know, 2000 AD fans that love the background of Mega City 1 and the enjoyment and the fantastic stories, as Jason said in the last, you know, those crazy video, those crazy stories like Couch Potato.
Right, I love that one.
Which is absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And I had to go back and read it. I also love
other places, you know. Yeah. We're also talking about Mega City 1 here. You know, there's the Cursed Earth.
Yes.
There are all sorts of elements of Mega City 1. You know, I always love the Undercity stories and the Big Smelly.
Yeah.
And there's some fantastic places to visit. Yeah. Whether we'll get a chance to visit all of them in even a long form TV show, maybe we'll have to wait for season 4 or 5 to encounter, Easy the Ferg.
But there's loads of great places that we've really sort of looked at, and you know, one of the key things is said, well, do we set our story? Where do we set our story? And we've talked about, you know, central. We've talked about whether it's on the outskirts of Mega City, or do we set our story in Cursed Earth? I mean, there's a lot of interesting places.
So long as there's a chase through the Agrodome.
Absolutely. We've got to do the Smokatorium. We need to play around with all sorts of different things. But, you know, there's the... there's so many places we can go, and quite frankly, that's one of the problems. We've got such a wonderful and deep library of the minds of brilliant writers and artists to kind of riff from. That what do we leave out is actually the issue.
That's the hard part.
Not what do we put in?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, we've sat and put together season one, and we've gone through that many times, and gone, you know, this is two seasons, so we've got to cut this down a bit. You know, it's getting bigger and bigger. Let's look at this and maybe change this and save this for later on. You know, and plus there's all these amazing sort of like, you know, crazy stuff that's happening there. Characters, all these, and we've talked about. I mean, we've talked about different places and stuff, but then you've got all the subcultures, all the different gangs, and characters. And stuff.
Well, just citizens themselves. There are fantastic series of stories you could do just about the lives of citizens. The job riots. You know, everybody's thousands of people turn up for a job. I mean, just that in itself is a fantastic illustration of megacity.
A little near the knuckle for these days.
Well, true, maybe.
But 2000 AD's always had that. You know, it talks about, you know, the culture and political environment that's happening within that era, sort of thing, you know, from the 70s all the way up to now. We've always had this very strong view of putting across political views and stuff.
I think it's good that 2000 AD stories are sometimes a little uncomfortable at times. I think that's sort of the spice. That's the difference between what Matt Smith and the team do with the comic book. It's the difference between that comic and perhaps others that are, you know, superhero style or whatever. I'm sure the superhero comics sort of deal with difficult issues sometimes, but I really think
what cape to wear?
Well, there is that. I mean, there's also limitations to what you can do if you're a superhero. They have superpowers, and that kind of
ruins their day.
Well, it means that it's a little harder to challenge them. Whereas we, broadly speaking, with 2000 AD, we have extraordinary people in extraordinary situations, but they're very rarely without their major flaws and without a kind of complex human backstory, which is really how you access and care about a person in a story.
Yeah. But they're always, what I find is we're reading the stories, they're mostly always human. They're human stories.
Listen, mutants or aliens.
Okay, listen, mutants.
Hey, mutants are people too. I mean, that's not getting...
That's true. What about, aliens then? Yeah, aliens. That was a bit of a Freudian slip for me there, wasn't it? Yeah, mutants are humans too. But, you know, the aliens mutants and the, you know, recently...
I need that T-shirt.
Recently, the Sensitive Clegg storyline, absolutely love that.
That is really cool.
He tries to integrate with society, and the fact that he's a 12-foot-high, carnivorous, reptilian attack beast upsets people.
Who loves poetry.
Understandingly, it's exactly what would happen if you were
But I think
mild-mannered 12-foot attack beast. Yeah.
But that's the nice thing about it, isn't it? Because there's always something there for someone.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're into the alien stories or the human stories. Well, I'd love to see Clegg's in it one day. But that's another thing, you know, it leads us onto a whole load of like different stories and different things that we could bring in. But, you know, Mega City 1, I think, is so ecliptic in itself, so massive, and there's so much that can come together through it. I think that you'll find that people will be quite excited.
Very final thing, we have a lot of very expectant Judge Dredd fans out there,
yes,
and not just Judge Dredd fans, but Dredd fans, as well as we've seen in the division of comments. What's the thing you want to say to them now at the beginning of this process? Is there something you want to reassure them about or enthuse them about what's coming up?
If I was them, I'd be exceptionally excited, but temper that excitement with the realization it's going to take us a long time to get this done. You know, nobody's going to be able to buy the box set in 6 weeks. You know, this isn't pre-publicity for the release of the show. This is kind of pre-publicity for us to even start making it. So what I would ask is a certain indulgence from the fans. If they can continue to follow us and continue to, you know, chuck in ideas and support us as brilliantly as they have been doing, that would be wonderful. But also to be a bit patient with us.
From the mad realms of Meltdown Man to the lethal world of Death Planet, Alan Hebden is one of 2080's most popular writers, and we had a nice long chat with Alan about his work and influences.
I've actually always been, I'd always been a science fiction fan.
Mm.
I was fortunate in the middle of the war stories and everything else, where we lived in Farnborough, there was not far off, there was a little, it was a second-hand bookshop where you could buy things for sixpence and sell them back for threepence, sort of like, you know, kind of a bit of a library in a way.
But, sure.
But not like the municipal library. This was one which was shelves packed full of Galaxy magazines and Astounding Tales, the monthly sort of collections of short stories, which of course showcased some of the best science fiction writers who ever lived at that time. And I used to go through those, like, just drank them up. Actually, I loved them, you know. And some of them were good, and some of them were a load of rubbish. But I quite like space pulp. That's what it was, in a way.
Mm.
But space pulp done well is just as good as anything else.
With things like Meltdown Man, it felt very much a kind of harking back to this kind of slightly fantastical SF that we've already talked about, where you have a straightforward sci-fi premise. Man gets vaporized by a nuclear explosion, finds himself in this incredible environment. Kind of a Planet of the Apes reversal kind of thing.
Sort of.
But it felt very much like coming from the earlier days of 2000 AD. So it was a lot more fantastical. It was fantastical SF. I mean, that had it always been your intention with that strip to you know, do something that was over the top and wild and fantastical?
Well, at the same time, write a story.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this has always been the most important thing.
Mm.
If you don't have a story, what have you got? Might have nice artwork, lots of people prancing about. But actually, you know, at the end of the day, you need a story to push it along.
Mm.
When you've got a good, solid story going with good characters and enough room to be able to move them around. I mean, basically, you know, I mean, I was able to split it into three separate stories, all running concurrently or running in parallel. But I didn't have to feature each one each week. I could concentrate on one character 1 week and another character another week. And it left room for, you know, it left room for kind of almost sort of domestic scenes and stuff. Like in Mind Wars too. I mean, you can maybe laugh at it. Like, what's wrong with it? I mean, like, what do you think everybody in the world is, all these people are going to constantly out marching around killing people or in fights or being, having their minds blown by some complete horror. I mean, it's that's not storytelling. That's like sort of just scenes.
Mm.
But I mean, somehow you've got to rope them together into an idea of a story. They have to have, I think, a coherence. And you can do that. It's surprising how you can have a quiet period in a story in it. And it kind of reinforces it. It certainly gives you a better idea of the characters. I wish I had more time to have really complicated characters, or complex characters anyway. They're what interests me. It wasn't so much the creatures or the animals or the stuff, it was the central characters that were important, and how they reacted and what they did and how they changed, you see. I mean, I even had time to actually change them. They weren't sort of, you know, people who set off on one side. I mean, I had the Tiger Commander was the most unlikely sort of switcheroo, but we were able to build up the story to the point where he was actually, that's all he could do. He had to sort of change sides. And whereas the tracker, Billy the pup, who was, his was a sort of longer conversion, a slower, more steady one, a bit like him, you see. And then when he, then finally it kind of dawns on him that he's working for the wrong side.
In the 1980s, Robin Smith played a big part in making 2000 AD look its absolute best, from providing cover roughs for artists to designing marketing material. And we had a two-part sit-down with Robin to discuss his career, 2000 AD's role in that, and some of his very interesting and quite humorous stories about working at the galaxy's greatest.
Based on what Steve said in his book and what Dave Bishop put Philip Howard over, I mean, these were quite significant money spinners for IPC, weren't they?
Absolutely.
But you had a very, very tight budget.
Yeah, if we're lucky to get a budget, you'd have to find, you'd have to look for every bit of artwork that was knocking around and being used. Now, annuals before, and I'm sure I know did this in an interview, annuals before, I know the first Dread annual that we did, Alan and I did, had been... You get some text story illustrations, you get a long text story, you put it in big type, and you put it onto a sugar paper annual, and you try and, you probably add a bit of half, it's usually two colour things, so you'd add a bit of colour to the couple of illustrations, and you'd spread it out, and you'd find any old strip was knocking around, and you'd probably fill up pages like that. Then you'd have a crossword, a word search. I think there's one puzzle section which I actually credited to A.A. Annengran, which was Alan Grant, which I'm still slightly pleased with. Obviously, that's really bad, isn't it? You make a joke like that and you're pleased with this many years later. But I don't know that Lucy, my wife, will tell you that she's sat up in a Tottenham flat filling in the black squares and the crossword. Yeah. So, but you do it like that. But what I've said this before, is when I was a kid, annuals were just like this.
Yeah.
And then they did a Dalek annual, which was probably called the Dalek book, but I'm sadly... got it, but I don't probably find a copy of it, be bothered to buy it. And it was full of great features, like, and it had no Doctor Who in it, that was quite good. It had the Dalek, it was just about the Dalek.
Yeah.
And it had things like a landscape with a, this is what a planet looks like when the Daleks have left, or a feature about what Daleks were like. So the fact that a Dalek can actually generate enough energy to light a city the size of Birmingham.
Right.
The fact it can travel at 60 miles an hour on a motorway. You know, it's like, but it was all Dalek related.
Yeah.
And there was like end papers of all the different Dalek vehicles they flew in and things. I mean, so I always wanted to do annuals that you try and be as inventive as you could with the stuff you had. And Alan was the same. So we'd just try and come up with stupid features, basically. And as you can tell, the ones that got the stupid features in. But of course, then you had the budget for some colour artwork.
Yeah.
So I think the first things, Mickey did those fantastic colour things. They were sent off to Italy to be printed. So they come with fantastic. And the colour proofs came back and you just... This is absolutely immaculate.
Yeah.
Absolutely lovely. So we always kind of tried to do as best we could with them and things.
Because you can tell when something is a little bit of filler. I mean, you know, certainly as the 80s go on, the polish increases.
Yeah.
But you get things like, you know, Mick McMahon's How to Draw Judge Dredd, Ian Gibson's How to Draw Judge Dredd. I mean, the sheer number of artists now I speak to who go... That was what made me want to be an artist.
Yeah, how to draw a Dalek. Oh, yeah. This is where this comes from. This is all the things that I... Yeah, so the Mickey, I can remember getting Mickey to do that. And apparently somebody's made a statue of that.
Yeah.
Planet Records, yeah. Yeah, no, so where's mine? That's the question. So that was me saying, can you do this, how to draw in stages and things?
Yeah.
And there was things that I really like. And there's things I'm sure I must have done it at some point. Which is, or they did it. What I always want to do is things like those features that used to be in Marvel Comics. So this is the Baxter Building. So it was a cutaway where the Fantastic Four lived and things. Yeah. Those sort of things. And there's a thing about, and I know it's reprinted in the British reprints. So I think I had it originally in colour. Iron Man putting on his armour, right? So he puts on the gauntlets, and there are little electromagnets that slide the sleeves up to the shoulder bits and things.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that. And I always thought that's the stuff you want to do with Judge Dredd. And if you remember, if you've ever seen the film Electroglide in Blue, right, which is about an American motorcycle cop, which is quite appropriate for Judge Dredd, it starts off with, you don't see the guy, but you see him putting on his American motorcycle gear. So you see him clip on the thing, put the gun on, put the boots. Yeah. You know, it's like all the gear goes on and things. And it's those sort of things that would make perfect Judge Dredd things, if anybody could figure out how Mickey had got the things to go on in the first place, obviously. So it was just trying to be inventive with it. And the budget would cover some cheap colour artwork.
Mm.
But of course, the artists fancied a go at doing some colour stuff because you very rarely got to do it. So, you know, Mickey would mix up a couple of buckets of paint. I think he was sharing a studio with Dave Gibbons at the time. And Dave would say, "What you got in the bucket there?" And he said, "I was doing a Judge Dredd angle then, are you, Mickey?"
We
just didn't get paid. All it was, the budget didn't involve Alan and I getting paid to be sitting up the King's Reach Tower till 11 o'clock at night doing it. I think it was the deal.
Then, I mean, that was going to be my next question. Then why? Why sink that sheer amount of money into something that, as far as the company was concerned, was thrown away?
Well, they didn't put that much money into it, if you think about it, because they were paying for the artwork, but we were using a lot of it. They were paying for some good bits of artwork. Yeah. The rest of it was just put together.
Mm.
So you'd say the annual would be, you'd have two colour stories, you'd have maybe another strip or something, but the rest of it would be stuff that wasn't used. So Casanova's stuff was used in an annual originally we had knocking around.
Yeah.
That had been done for something, it'd been bought, and then it was never used for whatever reason. That was resized and redone.
Mm.
So the annual had, it was like you had some good bits of it and you had to make the rest sort of match the good bits so you didn't go through the boring bits. Okay. But if you sold, remember what the sales figures of 2008 were? They were about 100,000 a week.
Yeah.
And you're going to sell a fair number of annuals to the people that want that, because they started selling them in, they were put together in the summer for the next Christmas. Mm. So they're always a year behind and things. And every kid got an annual. Every kid still gets an annual, I presume, except now it's probably a take that annual or whatever. I think that's probably changed the thing. But annuals were annuals. Everybody had them. That's why you'll see so many of them in jumble sales, in junk shops and things, because, and if that was your comic, you would have the annual for that.
Of course, it's not all been about 2000 AD this year on the Thrillcast. We've also done a few interviews and pieces on the Treasury of British Comics, the huge collection that Rebellion acquired last year, and it was great to sit down with Matt Smith and Keith Richardson to chat a little bit about the Scream and Misty special, which was the sellout hit of the autumn, full of revivals of classic strips.
And the thing that excited me more than anything else was the fact that we were purchasing Scream, because as much as I love 2000 AD, Scream always kind of it's always been my favourite comic anthology.
Yeah. Well, you're sat here in a Famous Monsters t-shirt. Yes,
I've always gravitated more towards horror. Yeah. And, you know, it was just a fun romp for kids. It was an exciting, fun comic. It was horror masquerading as comedy. Mm. And that really appealed to me. I'm very straightforward. I'm quite basic. Some of the 2000 AD stuff at the time was going over my head, as great as it is. I just like the fun of Scream. It was everything I wanted in the comic. So when we did purchase that archive, it was the first thing that I couldn't wait to kind of pour over again.
Mm.
So bearing in mind, we bought the archive, and yes, our focus is on the Treasury line, putting out some nice collections, a lot of which, you know, hasn't seen the light of, a lot of these strips haven't seen the light of day since they were originally published in some of these titles. But at the same time, we were also, this has been something that we've been planning on doing, the odd specials, like looking into the catalogue and seeing what's worth kind of doing new material, creating new material for. And Scream and Misty now is just perfect because you can kind of hang it on Halloween.
Mm. So tell us a bit about your editorial process on this, because Scream didn't last all that long. Certainly not in comparison to 2008, but didn't last all that long. But it was still an anthology, so it still has a lot of strips. Same with Misty as well. Relatively short run, but an awful lot of different strips.
That's right.
How did you decide? Was it a personal choice? It was like, well, these are my favourites.
There's a bit of both. I mean, thankfully, you know, it just so happens that the hands down, and no disrespect to anyone else who contributed to Scream, but I mean, hands down, the most popular and the best strip in there was the 13th Floor.
Mm.
Anyone involved with the comic will tell you that, and I think a lot of the fans would say that as well. So it was a no-brainer to have the 13th Floor in there.
Mm.
Now, the second strongest strip in Scream was probably the Dracula file. And let's face it, if you're going to have a horror anthology comic, Dracula is probably still and always will be the kind of pin-up poster boy for the horror genre.
Mm.
So straight away, I thought we'll have that in there as well. When it came to Misty, I mean, Misty was a revelation. I'd never read it until we bought the archive. Mm. I think when I was young, I bought one issue because there was a Weetabix promotion at the time. So you would, yeah, do you remember the Weetabix skinheads?
Yeah.
Kind of weird now.
Just a little.
Yeah, there was a promotion where you would get, I think there were five different characters. One was called Brains. I shouldn't remember that. Daisy, or was it Trixie, was the female. But anyway, you would get a different badge on a different IPC title.
Yeah.
And of course, the female Weetabix character was a free badge on the front of an issue of Misty.
Hmm.
Please tell me if I'm wrong. It might have been Ginny. I'm sure it was Misty. Anyway, I went out and bought that, but I'd never read the comic. I discarded it straight away because it was a comic for girls back then, which we all know is a complete nonsense. I'd never read. So basically, I'd never read Misty before.
Mm.
And it was a revelation picking it up. It was absolutely fantastic. Some mind-blowing art. It's introduced me to Shirley Bellwood, which is a great thing. I think she's very, very criminally even underrated. And there needs to be more talk about her as a British comic book great. Mm. There's some great stories. The thing about Misty is there aren't many ongoing series in there.
Yeah.
Luckily, we've managed to kind of select the Sentinels as our Misty strip.
Well, tell us a bit about the Sentinels. Sentinels,
to my mind, was the best strip in Misty.
Right, tell us a bit about it. What's the Sentinels about?
It's an urban horror. It's about these two twin blocks of flats, one of which people still live in, the other one's derelict. Mm. This young girl's living in the flats, and her family are getting evicted. She goes into the twin set of flats, and it leads her to a parallel dimension where Britain's been taken over by the Nazis.
Right, okay.
And it's really, really dark. I mean, the Misty strips were a lot creepier than anything you would probably find in any of the pages of Scream at the time. So it's just beautiful to look at and really, really well written by Malcolm Shaw. It's really good stuff. But I think, yeah, it's hands down deserves its place in this special.
On the subject of the Treasury British Comics, it was a delight to sit down with artist John Stokes to talk about not just Marnie the Fox, which was reprinted this year, but also his uncredited work on so many British Children's Weekly comics and even inking Grant Morrison's The Invisibles.
It doesn't strike me as a place and a time where comics would necessarily have been a particularly big part of your life.
I didn't read a comic until I was 9 years old.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know if my dad was either extremely adventurous or he seriously got up the noses of his superiors, but he was always posted to places like up on the North West frontier, like Rawalpindi and Quetta, where you wouldn't go these days without a flak jacket. So, I mean, I just had the weirdest childhood. I really don't think I saw a comic until we came back to England, and I would have been about 9 or 10. I mean, the first one I remember, no, I must have seen things like Lion before then, but the one I remember vividly was the week that Ego came out.
Right. Well, the great and venerable Eagle. What was the effect of seeing that for the first time? Not having had, you know, necessarily a great versing in comics. What was the effect on you?
I was overwhelmed by it. I mean, I suppose I had seen other comics, but just the quality of the production, the beautiful printing, the better paper, and the quality of the artwork of people like Frank Hampson and all the various artists that they had on there. I was just bowled over.
And was this because you'd moved back to Britain?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was incredible. I mean, you know, we took India for granted. That was just ordinary. But, oh, boy, the exotic food we had here, you know, chips and things like that. And my brothers and I used to ride around on the Circle Line just looking at that, amazed at all these houses, which were exactly the same. We'd never seen anything like that. You know, suburbia was just such a culture shock to us.
Let's talk a little bit about Marnie. Because we are reprinting it for the first time in a new edition through the Treasury of British Comics. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be? Because was it just, you know, the editor gets in touch with you or your agent and says, well, we've got this new strip, we want you to do it, or was the communication directly with you?
I didn't have an agent at that time.
Right, I see.
I've only ever had one agent for about a year or two, and so literally I just got it through the post from Oh, I wish I could remember his name. Whatever was it? Anyway, I got it through the post from the editor and said, you know, I must have still been, looking at the dates, I must still have been doing Fishboy at the same time. But it was obvious, you know, after that length of time, he'd been around the world about twice and had met every form of fish living and breathing. So it was obviously coming to an end. And then I just got this script saying, you know, can you do this next?
I mean, again, you know, I don't want to dwell on it, but that's a remarkable way of working because...
It was really weird, yes. Yeah. I mean, compared to nowadays, you look back on it, it seemed perfectly normal at the time, but it was very strange.
So tell us a little bit about the beginning of Marnie, the early days, because originally you wanted to draw it in a certain way that actually human beings were virtually cut out of it.
That was one of the things in the script.
Was it right?
That was Scott's idea that he wanted to focus on the animals, and in one of the early scripts, maybe even in script one, where Marnie runs up against, or maybe one or two, where he runs up against the farmer who eventually kills his mother, and it said, you know, all human beings should be shown from the knees down. You never see anything else. Well, I mean, it's a nice idea, and I see what he was driving at. But in terms of actually pictorial stuff, it means you couldn't go any, you know, there were no long shots, there were no establishing shots, anything like that. So that fairly quickly went out of the window.
And was that an executive decision that you made?
It was, I think, yes. I think I tried it that way, and it just looked so boring. It was as if somebody was trying to direct an epic, and they never took the camera away from sort of waist-high shots.
So what sort of turnaround were you looking at on an episode of Marnie?
Well, at the time I started Marnie, I think I was doing about three other strips. I was finishing off Fishboy, and I think, I can't think what it was, but I was doing something else. There was a time, which was just horrendous, where I was doing something like 7 pages, 8 pages a week. So a lot of times on Fishboy, I would start an episode at 9 o'clock, knowing I had to get it in the post by 5:30. And I don't know how I did it. I mean, I would literally have to do a panel every half hour.
And in terms of the sheer number of pages you would get through in a week, say, while having, I presume, you know, this another job with the theatre stuff, how many pages were you producing?
For a few months, for about 4 or 5 months, I think I was literally, I mean, doing six and sometimes 8 pages a week. But that was really killing. You know, I couldn't keep on at that rate. So I then dropped back to about 4, I think.
Okay.
At the same time as doing Marnie or the other strips for Buster and Paw. I was sometimes filling in for South American guys who were falling behind. So I did a stint on Kelly's Eye for a while and things like that. There was a football strip, I can't remember what it was in, called Raven, a sort of gypsy boy who was an ace footballer. I filled in on that for a while. So there was always something else going on at the same time. But with Marnie, I just knew I had to give it my best shot. I mean, Scott was living in Devon, and he obviously had loved books like Tarka the Otter. And he had just put so much descriptive writing into some of these scripts that I just knew I had to give it my best shot. So that was always, I always prioritized that. And I tried a lot of different techniques at first. Obviously, as you look at the later ones, I stopped doing the spatter and all these thumbprints and things like that because it was just getting too laborious.
What was it about, I mean, you mentioned the effort that Scott was clearly putting into it, but with a strip that is on such a tight deadline, where you're doing lots of other stuff, is it personal pride? Is it professional pride that means you go, you know, I want to do my best on this. I want to go that extra mile.
I think it just must have been the script, Mike, because, I mean, I was doing lots of other things, and I, even with Fish Boy, which I stuck at, nobody else ever drew an episode or a panel of Fish Boy. I did the whole of that stint. So I must have had some sort of professional fight, but somehow it wasn't as deep as with Marnie. I could sense with Marnie that there was something else here I could really get into, as well as doing a strip which is exciting and people liked. You could say something about, you know, the landscape, because I was living on the boat at the time, and it was an idyllic existence. You know, if I worked late at night or early in the morning, I would see kingfishers coming and landing on my mooring ropes and things like that. So I suppose it just happened at that time of my life when I was very into the countryside, and I could really put all of that into the strip.
One of the big launches of the year was 2080, the Ultimate Collection from Hachette Partworks. And it was great fun to welcome Simon Bisley into the studio, where we chatted with Pat Mills about Slain, the Horned God. Pat, you mentioned there about the look of Slain as being consistent. It's interesting how the different artists who've worked on it, so people like, you know, Mick McMahon, Angie, who came up with the original look, Glenn Fabry, Simon Davis at the moment, and so many others, have taken those core elements that were laid down at the very beginning, done their own spin, but those remain in place.
Yeah, I think there's probably more freedom on Slain than there might be on Judge Dredd.
Mm.
And I think that's a freedom that the artists have taken anyway. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, for instance, I started off with Slain, and I thought, well, you know, who should be the bad boy to base him on? And at that time, it was Jack Nicholson. And progressively, the artists themselves saw themselves as bad boys. So if you look closely at the Horned God, of course, you'll see Simon there as Slain.
Oh, here I am. I'm on Batman as well, and Judge Dredd, if you look.
So are you a bad boy, Simon?
Oh, not at all. Not
you're angelic.
It's just rumours. Yeah. I'm a gentleman. I mean, I love you, fella. Entirely.
Pat, in terms of approaching the Horned God as a reader, now, when we talk to people at conventions, when we talk to people online about the Horned God, some of them become quite reticent because they go, oh, well, this is mid-series. This isn't the beginning. You know, I'm jumping into the story. And yet the one thing that's really struck me about the Horned God is how very quickly immersive it becomes. So even if you've never read a page of Slain in your life, which I hadn't when I first came across the Horned God, it grabs you straight away. It draws you in.
Yeah, it's because there are various elements that have been set up in the previous stories. So the Horned God was definitely going to be the story I had to write. And then, incredibly, Simon came along, and he had the stamina and the endurance to do four volumes, which would have been a real challenge for Glenn, I think. Mm-hmm. But it was always the story I wanted to do because it's a Celtic legend, and it's a Celtic legend that was crying out to be dramatised.
Mm. Well, this is what is interesting from a purely practical point of view about the Horned God. So, it's Pat, you mentioned the printing processes had changed, so it was allowing fully painted artwork to be mass produced like this for the first time in British comics. Mm. But at the same time, the people who were printing it didn't necessarily understand its capabilities, how it needed to be tweaked.
Well,
so,
what they would do, I mean, yeah. A great statement is you'll find that today, where you will spend a long time messing around to get the right contrast, the right colours, the right tone, etc. And it can be very complicated to get the right look because on the screen there's a light behind the artwork, so it looks nice and bright, but once you print it on paper, it's very, very dark.
Hmm.
But what I'd find is that Joe Schmo would be on the tech on the printer machine, big cogs and levers probably. Then would just boost the colour up, do this and do that, and not have a clue. I had no clue how to adjust anything, so the artwork could become, of course, just very diabolical. And the paper, listen to me rant. And the paper was like toilet paper in those days, you know, bringing a pulp quality to it, so it would absorb and then the ink was slightly spread a little, you know. Actually, it's interesting because I found out that with digital artwork, the line, the black line, it thickens because it's digitized, because you can't get a fine true line. It's staggered as it digitally, isn't it? Mm. So no, it's my artwork because it's, you know, let's not talk about me anymore, but forget that. But it's all very well. But now I think if it'd be nice if they could refine the work, refine it, like they lost it before. Get the work again and just and get it scanned again and bring it out as real glory.
Digitally remaster it or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, remaster it. And even have honestly say, well, these are pieces we couldn't get. So yeah, I think purely, the thing is, this is, I'm not really too bothered about the whole damn thing because it's the past, it's gone. Mm. So, but I'm sitting here now, I'll talk about it, and it's part of my life. And I think it's made me realise that as you get older, it's what you carry on in your life by through what you've done, and you give. Your giving is a giving thing. Mm. So I think it's almost like the, you know, the slain become my gravestone. Do you know what I mean? That's my life. There you are. There's Bisley. That's his work.
Right.
That's what he did. So it's that's kind of an epitaph kind of thing, you know? It's a... Do you know what I mean? So is it, what I'm saying, it lives beyond us, and Pat will agree that his name will live, you know, when he's dead. This book maybe is still going to be read by people a long time ahead, you know.
It's always interesting to get a different perspective on 2000 AD and the wider comics industry from people who don't necessarily work with 2000 AD. And crime writer Ian Rankin was a fascinating chap to speak to, not just about 2000 AD, its influence on him, but also on his feelings regarding comics and literacy. Is there something quite pure about the storytelling in comics that is right there in front of you? You can't disguise it with flowery language. You have to be quite economical, particularly in British comics where you've only got a set number of pages to play with. Do you think that kind of, I don't know, focuses the mind a little bit?
I mean, it's. I'm not really answering your question, but something that was, I think, very important to my generation as well, and possibly it affected Alan, was punk.
Hmm.
Punk came up, we had this very flowery progressive rock music where it was all, you know, it was all synthesizers and organs and capes and you had to have gone to the right schools and the right colleges, and you had to be able to afford the right instruments and everything. Mm. You had to be classically trained as a musician, all that stuff. We'd had that, and then suddenly punk came along and blew that out of the water, and I was 17 in 1977, the perfect age for punk. And what punk said as an aesthetic, as a philosophy, was just go out and give it a go.
Yeah.
You don't need to know people in the industry. You don't need to have gone to the right schools. You don't need to be able to afford all the right gear. Just try it. Give it a go. And we had a school. We started a school magazine. You know, I did join a punk band for a short time as the vocalist. I was writing the lyrics. We went into the studio. We had no idea what we were doing, but we weren't going to let anybody tell us we couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And that was very important. You know, coming from my background, it's kind of working class. Didn't know anybody who was a writer, didn't know anybody who wrote novels or who was a poet. Suddenly arriving at Edinburgh University in 1978, the band at Freshers Week were the Ramones. They played at Freshers Week. And Peru Boo are playing and stuff. And all this music, you know, because punk very quickly became something more complex and richer, actually. The kind of new wave stuff that came after them.
Mm.
The quite dark, gothic-y stuff that came afterwards, The Cure and people like that. Took you to another place as well. But, you know, crucially, you know, nobody was asking you what school you went to. If you had any interest in doing this stuff, do it.
Mm.
And that was huge. And, I mean, I think that did channel into the British comic scene as well. You know, there's a lot of kind of people who were kind of self-taught and weren't going to take no for an answer.
Well, I mean, there was a real kind of DIY ethos with punk. I mean, and you see it in you know, the zines and things like that that started started popping up. And it's, I think it's notable how many of the journalists and writers that I know and respect cut their teeth on that kind of, well, you know, we like this thing, so we're just going to make it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at high school we started a magazine called Mainlines, which was mostly reviews of Clash albums and reviews of pubs that would let you in even if you weren't 18. you know, as soon as I got to university, there was friends of mine started a poetry magazine, and various poetry magazines came and went. Bands were emerging every 5 or 10 minutes, and you could leap in and join a band for 10 minutes, and then they didn't want you anymore. The band split up, and then you went on to another band. And it was just an extraordinary kind of melting pot of ideas. And, you know, people were trying to make movies. People were trying to script movies. People wanted to be performance artists. People wanted to be actors. It was just all this melange of people giving stuff a go. And, of course, 99% of it was either no good or they lost interest after a while.
Mm.
But as a means of getting started, it was fantastic because you were meeting like-minded people who were just game for anything. And we all read 2000 AD. We all read 2000 AD. I mean, it was one of the kind of things that, you know, it was almost like walking in school in the 70s with your Rick Wakeman album, and you would suddenly find out who your friends were. You know, you'd be sitting in the student union with a copy of 2000 AD,
yeah.
And people would be going, oh yeah, you know, I like Alan Moore. Do you like Nemesis? Yeah, I love Nemesis. What, you know, you like Rogue? Yeah, I'm not so keen on Rogue Trooper. What about Judge Dredd? Yeah, but it does show a kind of dystopian society. I don't know whether I like him or not because he's not the kind of, you know, just all that kind of conversation, and all the humor that was in it as well. I remember sitting in my student flat that I shared with a few friends from high school. And we were sitting talking about Rojas and Hammerstein from 2000 AD. And we suddenly looked at each other and went, Rodgers and Hammerstein. We suddenly got it. We hadn't got it until then. It was the most obvious pun in the world.
you'd be surprised whenever we did, because we on the Facebook page for 2000 AD, we do like a daily classic cover. And whenever it's Rojas and Hammerstein, there's always somebody in the comments who says, oh, I just got that. And they're like in their 50s. Well, what a journey it's been over the last 12 months, Earthlets. Hope you've enjoyed these little highlights from the year of the Galaxy's Greatest Podcast. Join us in 2018 when not only do we celebrate our third birthday, but we continue to bring you the inside goss and behind the scenes info on 2000 AD in 2018. Happy New Year and Splendig Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the Galaxy's Greatest Comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.